Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, a bi-weekly look at the arts in and around the Cambridge 105 area. As the winter closes in, imaginative storytelling takes over as the inspiration behind much of what is happening, but some people prefer to experiment in clay, and others to look at more supernatural themes of the winter nights with more exotic offerings. In this edition, poet John Lyons reads some of his work inspired by the myths and legends of Trinidad and Tobago as he opens a new exhibition of his paintings at the Freeworks Gallery in Cottenham. Wising Art's Eleanor Morgan previews a new Sellers exhibition of 12 artists who've collaborated to do something a bit special with clay. Fairy tale Hansel and Gretel opens the seasonal family fun at the Junction, and little kids are on the menu, or are they? And just what does it take to become a belly dancer? We hear from a teacher performer on rippling with beauty and success. I expect you've never heard of a jumbie before, and neither had I until I spent a remarkable evening with poet and artist John Lyons, his wife Jean and friends, as he opened a new exhibition at the Frameworks Gallery in Cottenham Village. Well, what is it, you might ask? A jumbie is the living soul of a departed partygoer in the tradition of Trinidad and Tobago that just keeps partying in the moonlight long after popping his or her clogs and is quite the opposite of a zombie. Such folklore is the lifeblood and inspiration which has sustained the career of John Lyons, whose feet never seem to touch the ground in terms of working on so many key arts projects, being intensely creative and winning a series of literary prizes. Winner of the Windrush Arts Achiever Award in 2003, Lyons was born in Trinidad and educated as an artist and art educator at Goldsmiths College and the University of Newcastle upon Tyne. During those years, without a grant, he had to work. Some of his part-time jobs included being a factory cleaner, a waiter, a postman, and a hospital porter. Money's never been real in his world, I'm told, and his passion for writing naturally grew from addictive reading of novels and poetry at a very early age. Lyons' art is all underpinned by famous tales and experiences he had growing up in Trinidad, which have a supernatural and mystical theme and often help banish troubling spirits in the darkness. Artist Craig Kerrico of promotions agency Ovenden Contemporary introduces Lyons.
John's from Trinidad, and the vast majority of his portfolio refers back to the mythology that he grew up with as a child. So there'll be very common motifs like owls and fish and things that are common in Trinidadian mythology.
So they all have, basically, they're underpinned by folklore and tales, basically,
yes.
Aren't
yes.
they?
And
some of them quite haunting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's surprising. There's always something new in a painting. It doesn't matter how many times you look at it, there's always something that you missed the last time. As I was saying earlier, we have a different, a wide spectrum of artists, and John's one of our very well-established artists that we work with, but he still, you know, enjoys having us set up exhibitions for him, set up opportunities for him. So we've been working with John since 2007.
On taking a look at Lyons' figurative paintings, you'll see figures ranging from werewolves to mystical beings and mythical creatures and animals such as owls. There are plenty of ghosts and encounters in the moonlight depicted, and they have a way of sucking you into the hinterland between this world and the next, or at least respecting what might be out there, giving portents of your destiny. It has to be said, he's used to singing for his supper and he's very good at it, and like Othello, his storytelling won him an English wife, Jean, who's currently running the Family Adams Arts Project in Littleport. We joined him in full flight for some poems and discussion.
Now, the first poem I'm going to read is called A Painted Self. And the reason why I'm reading this poem, because it actually describes really the essence of how one looks at painting and the experience one can have looking at paintings. You know, quite often people say, what does it mean? And they want an intellectual sort of, sort of explanation. And I say, no, go for it. Do you like the color? You know, and I lead them into responding to it in a totally different way rather than a solely intellectual, rational sense way. And because I think you enter into an engagement with what you look at. You bring your whole life experience into looking at something. And I think that's the only way, really. So therefore it can mean different things to different people. I mean, say, because once, even myself, I get surprised when I'm finishing a painting and I said, wow, what's that? I didn't realize, gosh, that looks like a fish in the cloud. Did I paint that? And I had no intention of doing it, but it's a gesture of the brush. And my approach to it and my whole willingness to go with feelings and to go with, you know, my emotions, to go with what comes intuitively. And I think that's when you really create, when you're not sure where you're going with this. Because the art is in the process, not in the thing that goes on the wall. It's the process of doing it. A painted self, and the painting is talking. My beginning, the notional space in an empty canvas, primed for infinite possibilities with gestures of the brush. Their power to shape emotions, evoke personal histories. I revel in this artist's surrendered will to speak the language of color. Blood scarlet, scattered like constellations in the ambiguity of my picture space. Naked figures in a semblance of that biblical fall. But they're not falling. They're dancing without guilt, defying gravity. And this unlined face marks to white, like the fool's, is waiting for the scribbled script of a poet's free verse, the story of my image ever changing with as many eyes that gaze on me. I live in their gaze. It is my way of experiencing who I really am. And that is really how the painting feels. And it enters into a sort of dialogue with now the whole what is left is a mixed bunch. You got to tell me when to stop, you know, because you got to tell me where to stop. Now the paintings on the wall, I'm going to read poems that relate to vaguely to what's on the wall, you know, the paintings on the walls. There are characters there on the wall. This one is the Jumbie Bird, for instance. There's a Jumbie Bird in one of them there. But the Jumbie Bird is an owl. We call and think of it as an owl in Trinidad. It has a rather an interesting sort of persona, character. We think, people in Trinidad think of it only in a very sinister way. It is an, you know, it's a forerunner of something horrible thing to happen. But in the West, I think people think of it as wise owl. And I often wonder, okay, fine, why is it wise? And it maybe because people think of it as having death, and I think, okay, there's death and there's life. But it's somewhere in between. It can go through, it can fly one to the other. So it lives in a liminal existence between two worlds. And that's very important for me because I think, you know, it talks about what's real and what's not real and all the rest of it. But it's an owl, and in this particular case, it's speaking about how people think about it, but at the same time, it's saying, here I am, I'm an owl. But not in those words, I'm showing you rather than telling you, okay? Jumbie Bird. In my country, night is a hunting day. I see where rodents run, and my wings cut the darkness in a sharp swoop. Blood has no color in the night, only the warm, sticky taste of flesh ripped. Death is familiar as food. I see the sun long before it tints the sky. Then, homing in to my silk cotton perch, where a fragment of night is caught in a cluster of leaves, I close my eyes, drift into dreams, slide down a beam of light to some place where death sits heavy on the ailing. Three times I hoot, midday catches me, sleep flying, casting shadows on a house of grief. And that's what they say. If an owl comes at midday, anywhere near a house, an owl comes at midday, that's it. And someone is ill there, that's it. They've had it, you know? So I know it sounds very sinister, all this, but in fact, it's the stuff of life for writers and painters and creative people. you know, because life is like that. It's mysterious. It's you know, it's not boring, actually. It's not boring at all. This little one is called Papa Bois. And Papa Bois is in the convention, that painting over there. You know, he's got a bird, a nest on his head with a bird on it. And across there, he's a shape shifter. He changes his shape. There he's almost like a satyr, you know, with a cloven hoof across there, where he's meeting he's in assignation with another creature called Mama Maladie. But here's Papa Bois. It's in italics, it's not all that easy to read. Papa Bois, I was the child, frightened by your old man's puckish grin, raw gash across your forest face, like a dry season ravine. I heard moonlight tales about you, how you took with magic ease the dare's form, turned hunters into the animals they hunted. You wrote the bush lore book on leaves of trees and blades of grass. With your breath, you scribbled on the surface of evaporating pools, counsel for easy fishing to the waterfowl. You of wire and conniver in La Jablesse's fatal coquetry, laying snares like Venus mantraps for romantic saga boys who seek her favors. Oh, spear me, your noose of vines. I am no agouti chaser, no lagley setter. My venture into your forest twilight world was the lure of your bush wisdom. And an agouti, of course, is like a young deer. A lagley is like a snare. We used to sort of chewing gum. People want to catch birds, you know. And of course, Papa Bois is someone who guards the forest, and you can't kill animals, you know, like that. He will allow a certain amount for food, especially in the poor areas in the country where people were starving and they needed protein, all right? So he would allow a certain amount, but if you go beyond that amount, you'll find yourself with a vine around your neck and you've been strangled. You know, he looked after the animals. He was the first ecologist, I think. You know, artist, if you're a poet or painter or writer or dancer or whatever, you draw all your experiences from life around you. And I cannot, although I have a memory of my past, I'm living here and I live in the present quite often. So I'm taking things in like that. So I attempted to write a poem that brings the two worlds together in two parts. And one of the painters that he's a painter as well, that I admire a lot, was Derek Walcott, who got the Nobel Prize for Literature, I think it was in 1980, something like that. He was, you know, he's from St. Lucia, and he lived in Trinidad for a while, and his family's in Trinidad, some of his family. So, as mentioned, I'm really the Hebden Bridge. Here's this country. Weather Vane, this is called. First part, one. Not easy to understand the hard fettle of Hughes's poetry, distilled with the Calder Valley, where the sun keeps its distance and the sky is a puckered tissue, graying everything. Sometimes there's a blessing in perceiving language in landscape, autumn in midwinter, with gamboge yellow, Indian red, blue wood smoke lifting amidst craggy sycamores, their dark blooms of rooks' nests. Two. Quick as a thought, I find myself in a Walcott haunt, Trinidad, where miles of coconut palms crowd the beach towards Chaka Chakari, like Columbus's first Arawaks at Punta Arenal. His poetry is the sea. Stanzas break into patterns of spume on sand. Endings enjambed like meaning, historic, at one with the rhythm of the island. Here, the sun is gratuitous, and there's no escaping its indifference. Here, his metaphors are thin disguises for the island's life lust. Back in the Calder Valley, I see the seasons falter. Forsythia, deceived into bloom. Search for the dactyl in Caribbean cassia. And the dactyl is, as I was explaining to some of my students only this week, is got, you know, the iamb is the bum, ba bum, the boys, the don, the burn, the deck. The dactyl is carnival, carnival, cambule, bum, ba bum, bum, ba bum. That's the dactyl in the rhythm of poetry. It is just three syllables. Carnival. And it begins with the first word. Carnival, cambule, bum, ba bum, bum, ba bum. It sounds like beef, bum, ba bum, bum. That's what I was looking for.
John's love of stories fueled his talent, and he likes to talk about art vividly.
Can we talk a little bit about your work? Because it seems to contain lots of things that involve the subconscious and supernature, hauntings, myths, creatures and things like that. Where does it all come from?
Well, I'm not sure whether this, you could call it fortunate or unfortunate, but I come from a culture and a background in Trinidad where there's a lot of the numinous. You know, a lot is happening like that. There are a lot of superstitions. It's almost, you know, it's tangible in the atmosphere of the place. I mean, say we're not all always like that, but I mean, they say there are a lot of mythologies and legends and superstitions and things like that in my country. There's a sign for everything. If there's, you know, if a bird fly across your field of vision, a blackbird, oh my, oh, what's that? You know, something's gone, yeah, you know, and so on. That is that sort of background.
So it's superstition, it's things that come in the night, it's a fear of death, and there's a story for each one of those things, isn't there?
Yeah, it's the unconscious, really.
Yeah.
That's what it is. You know, everything might appear calm on the surface, but anything that runs into like a deep river, there's depth there. It's, you know, it might appear calm, but and the calmer, you know, the deeper it is, the calmer it appears perhaps on top. But there's a lot of depth.
Now, each of your images are basically based around a myth or a legend or a story. Did you love stories when you were a child?
Oh my gosh, I love stories. I told stories myself, actually. I made them up too. Sort of, you know, stories, we live stories. We actually, as kids, especially at moonlight, all the urchins around in the village or town, friends, that is, we would also meet on the steps at the back of the house, and we'll tell stories, and usually stories, the scary stories. So at the end of the session, hardly anyone wants to get up and go to bed because of that, you know.
Sort of. Now, your ideas and feelings that reach into the soul and psyche basically go in two directions. They go into your poetry, but they also go into these wonderful figurative images that we're looking at here this evening. What is it that you try to achieve with an image such as that one over there, where you have creatures, you have almost ghostly figures coming out of clouds, and you have bodies and all kinds of things that seem to be reaching out from somewhere? What is it you're trying to do with the painting?
Well, actually, what I am doing, I get a feeling and an idea, and because I've lived with a bit of numinous thing for so long, I just paint, you know. And what interests me about painting is the language of painting, using shape, line, color, texture on a flat three-dimensional surface, and it's a language for me. And I use that language freely, almost like, you know, like when you, if you're flow writing, you know, when you just write and let your hand, you know, automatic writing is a bit like that with me. When I start, I have a subject in mind, obviously, I know what it's going to be about, but I'm not sure how I'm going to get there or how I'm going to say it. But I just paint, and usually it's quite gestural, and sometimes I have to go away, because if I start thinking too much about anything, I stop. Because thinking puts me in a different plane, a different world, you know? So I remain there, and I just follow intuitively what comes, really.
John Lyons performs next at Williams Arts Exhibition in Gwydir Street in January and has a website for details. What do you get when you assemble a dozen radically different artists and they then spontaneously collaborate together using one medium to explore it and find something entirely new? At first, a lot of cracked pottery flying around the room and some unexpected fireworks. At least that's what happened when a group of regional artists working with Wising Arts residents in Bourne banded together to create a new cellars exhibition of contemporary work in clay, which opens this evening. Contemporary slipped as an attempt to discover new things working with clay, with each artist working from a different perspective. It combines sculptures, paintings and performance videos, all focusing on ceramics. The centre's pseudo-academic institution, the Department of Overlooked Histories, the third in a series of thinking themes, looks at tradition hitherto not fully explored. Aaron Angel takes a sculptural approach with folk art and crafts. Coco Crampton looks at works exploring mass production and cottage industries without hierarchy. There's also new work by Caroline Aitchinter, Lucy Canocci, Simon Davenport and Mark Essen. Lawrence Lehman, Phil Root, Giles Round and Jesse Wine have also collaborated, creating masks and new ways of looking at familiar material. Eleanor Morgan, artist and programmes curator at Wising Arts Centre, says it's been an opportunity for Wising to act as a catalyst for collaborations.
I guess it's a difficult show to put together because each of the artists is dealing with this same material from different stances. So quite different approaches. So some people are interested in collaborative practice with groups like the Amiga Workshop of the Bloomsbury Group and how they worked together as a group of makers. And other people probably wouldn't even be able to tell that the work was made of ceramics in the first place. So it's quite a challenge to pull it all together into a cohesive show.
This show is bringing together how many artists in total?
11 in total.
And these artists are used to working together anyway, are they, at Wising? Or?
Some have worked together, but a lot of them have been brought together through making work for the exhibition. So some of them have come from the residency programme, other people have been drawn to Wising because of the facilities here, but they've each explored them together in the ceramic studio on site.
And what's happened while they've been working together? Have they kind of hit on things between them or discovered new things?
Yeah, it's been a really exciting process of kind of peer learning, I suppose, and critique. So some people have more expertise in making pots and some people can actually throw and are quite expert, and others are really just beginning, and so they bring a freshness. The exciting thing is that a lot of the work isn't actually finished yet. but yeah, there's a real range. So there's one 2 meter tall sculpture, which is a steel frame with a ceramic plate or kind of mask form hanging on it. And that's by Caroline Akintray. There's some work which has quite a domestic scale and functional feel. So there's going to be a small installation of tables and chairs with ceramics on the table. And other works have more of a kind of the week.
Now Phil Root is one of the artists involved. Can you tell me a little bit about what he's been doing? Because I've seen quite a lot of his work in the past, and he always seems to be doing something off a tangent, something different, something new. Can you tell me about his work?
He's a very exciting artist. And I suppose for this show he comes in two guises. One is as himself, just straightforward Phil Root, and he's presenting a series of plaques which are painted, and they're very much an extension of his practice as a painter who uses canvas. And the other way that he's appearing is as part of the Grantchester Pottery Group, which is an attempt to create works commissioned by two artists, Giles Round and Phil Root. So they're asking other artists to give them patterns, and they will then put those patterns into mass production. We've just finished the final residency of the year, which was framed as the Institute of Beyond. And this show is one of three Wising Arts Contemporary Selling exhibitions of the year. And so next year we'll have a similar framework of exhibitions and residencies, but really Wising is it's a space for experimentation and for artists to make new work.
If fairy tales are your thing, you'll be pleased to hear that Hansel and Gretel opens this month at the Junction.
Alex, here we are in the Junction, and we're surrounded by some very strange objects indeed. Can you describe what we have here on the set of...
Well, we've got the outline of what will be our frosty winter forest. There's quite a lot more of it still to build, but in the rehearsal room we've got the basic outline of it. We've got our Hansel and Gretel's little metal bed, We've got the puppets of Hansel and Gretel, because we're doing a kind of puppet world and a human world mixed together. We've also got all of the musical instruments that are used in the show. It's a lot of live music in the show. We've got double bass, we've got trombone, we've got ukulele, we've got guitar, lots of percussion and trombone in the show. I might have said that twice. And accordion, of course. And we've got the witch's stove over there in the corner where she gets ready to cook little Hansel, and we've got our beautiful carpet on the floor, which is, and also the Hansel's cage over there for when the witch puts him in a cage.
So it's all the stuff of fantasy and fairy tales. What do you think it is about Hansel and Gretel that makes people want to tell this story again and again?
Oh, it's a very cruel story in a way. It's about famine and it's about a murder, and you know, it's got a lot of very kind of cruel fairy tale elements to it. An evil witch who lives in the forest, and I think the image of the gingerbread house is, you know, it's a very strong sort of idea. This magical cottage in the woods. I think the reason why it survives so long is because it's a great story. It's a great adventure. It has two children as the heroes. They have to stick together, they have to be brave, they have to work out how to escape. And also it has that feeling of their, which I think kids really like, the main characters are really in jeopardy. You know, they're really in big trouble. They're going to, you know, they're on the edge of disaster and they just about manage to escape. So I think the reason why it stays around so long is it has that sort of classic archetypal story shape. And I think that the idea of being lost in the forest, that's a very sort of human and universal sort of theme or idea.
How is Encounter Theatres?
New International Encounter.
New International Encounter. How have they adapted this tale, especially for the Junction Theatre? What's different about what you're doing?
Well, we generally make... one of the things we do is we bring artists from different countries to work together. So in this show, there's one of the performers is from Switzerland, one is a Spanish, he's a Basque, but he's Spanish-Basque, and one is from Norway, and then we've got two English performers in the show. So we use some mixture of languages in the show. Most of the story is in English, but we use the play of different languages as part of the performance and have a bit of fun with that. And the other thing we do is generally I work with actors who play music. So as I said, there's all these instruments around, and there are the song will be created and sort of generated through beautiful folky Central European music played live by the actors on stage. So that's a big part of what we do. And the other thing we've done here, which is maybe slightly different from some of the stuff we've done in the past, is we've got two puppets who are puppets of Hansel and Gretel. There are two actors who play them as well, and we interchange a little bit between a sort of puppet animated world and a human adult-sized world. And I think that allows us to do some things in the show which would be quite difficult if we weren't using that kind of animation.
Is it great fun to take on board a kind of caricature personality of a fairy tale figure?
Oh, we have great fun with for example, with the witch or the stepmother. Those are great. I mean, the stepmother in this show will sing a lovely, very stupid song. But of course, she's an evil, you know, she eats children. It's a great thing to do. And I think kids love that kind of cruelty. As long as it's okay in the end, as long as there's hope, as long as there's a chance. You know, I don't think kids like depressing material. Character of the witch who lives in the forest in her little gingerbread house. And she's a terrible, evil character. But in this show, she'll sing a song and she even does a little bit of a dance routine as well. And I think that there's huge joy in playing those kind of characters. They're kind of big and brash and great fun. But obviously she's an evil child-eating witch who tries to imprison them and eat little Hansel. So, you know, I think as long as it's fun, as long as the audience see that we're playing and messing around with those ideas. Right. We have a lot of fun kind of talking about whether we think she's a witch or not, and asking the audience even, do you think she's a witch? And, you know, don't you think she's a witch? Why do we think she's a witch? I think it's the same with the stepmother as well. You know, she's a kind of an archetype. Evil character who comes from sort of our sort of classic imagination of an evil stepmother, and we debate that a little bit in the show as well. Why is she bad and what's wrong with a stepmother? Because, you know, lots of people these days have stepbrothers, stepsisters, half brothers, half sisters, and so on. So there's a much more, but I think in the fairy tale world that the stepmother is genuinely a terrible threat and an evil character who has ill will towards you for sure.
It's no secret that most women want to be fit and sexy, and as the years advance a bit, those regular gym visits can be something of a bind. Well, there's a solution that can literally put the fire into your belly and help you exude health and beauty of a sort that men simply couldn't argue with. Why not try taking up belly dancing lessons? Leila Torelli teaches belly dancing and belly dance fitness, and she says that most women she meets have absolutely no idea of their hidden beauty and assets until they learn to perform with them, and it really gets the body in tip-top shape.
What is the backdrop to belly dancing? Where does it originate from?
There's lots of theories about this. Yeah. Some people believe that it was the gypsies who brought it from India, and along the gypsy trail it changed and mixed with the local music and local dance forms.
Is it very much still alive in Europe as an art form, and has it changed much over the years?
Belly dancing is very alive, would you believe, in Britain. Even in villages, they have belly dancing classes. Lots and lots of women are doing belly dance.
Okay. Now, you're seeking to teach belly dancing, or do teach belly dancing. How can people get involved in it, and how difficult is it?
Of course, it takes time to learn belly dancing to a high level, but can start. You know, the music's great, it's good fun, and it's very good exercise. So even as a beginner, you can have a lot of fun with it.
Do you need to sort of train your muscles in order to undulate and do all of those things?
Yeah. Well, belly dancing is much about isolation. So you need to be able to isolate different parts of your body and move them separate to the rest. So you might be completely still apart from your hips or your chest. And so that does take some training, and you do have to teach your body to do the moves that we do in belly dance.
Those movements are mesmerising, that they involve lots of big moves, that they're very sexy. Is it a form of expression that's different from other kinds of dancing and things like that?
It certainly is. It's an expression of being a woman, and being sexy is part of being a woman.
Yeah.
It's also cheeky and fun and energetic and sometimes quite introverted. Mm-hmm. It depends on the music.
Mm. Now, people do belly dancing, obviously, all the way from Morocco to Marrakesh to Egypt to Beirut. Does it vary very much in the different origins? Yes.
Absolutely. There's some variation in the music and some variation in the dance vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And also there are factors in history which have had an effect. For example, in Egypt, women were made to cover up more and they weren't allowed to do floor work, and you had to sort of be upright more. And so that affected Egyptian dance. Whereas in Turkish belly dance, you'll find that there's much more floor work. It's more energy. I would, if we were to compare with Egyptian, which is, I'd say, probably energetic, and there will be more floor work.
Mm. I've witnessed in Marrakesh and Morocco belly dancers who appear and make shrill noises with their tongues, and they belly dance fabulously. It's wonderfully choreographed performing art, and they're also able to do it even with a tray of drinks on top of their head at the same time. It must require a lot of balance and a lot of skill to do that kind of thing.
Yes, and lots of practice.
So tell me about your classes. What would they involve, and if once someone wanted to get involved and become an accomplished belly dancer?
So I have classes on Monday nights at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and those classes are for belly dance and choreography. And I teach choreography, which my class will learn, and they can perform it to their own friends, and we also sometimes get asked to perform at various events. And so anybody who wishes to take part in those can. And my belly dance fitness classes are more of a mix. It's not just belly dancing. I also include Bollywood, a bit of hip hop, some other types of dancing, and that is less about intricate technique and intricate choreography and more about just dancing through the whole hour.
Have you always done belly dancing, or did you do other kinds of dancing before doing it? And is it difficult to make the transition between one kind and another, for instance jazz dancing or something like that?
The transition isn't difficult, it just adds to your vocabulary. It's great to do lots of different types of dancing, and I have done lots of different types of dancing. I find that What I would say as a dancer is that you train in your main type, but you get influenced by other dancers, other dance forms, and you develop your own style from it.
Is it also reasonably easy to make money as a belly dancer, performing at parties or events and things like that? Is it lucrative? Can it be lucrative?
It's not. I wouldn't say it was that lucrative. When you dance in a restaurant, it depends. You know, sometimes you get good tips. Mm. Parties are quite fun. Mm. I recently did a party for a group of women who wanted a belly dance, like a workshop. So I taught them a simple little choreography that they could take away and perform to their friends, boyfriends, husbands, who, you know, whatever they want. And I also did a little performance for them. And it was great fun. We all dressed up.
I was going to move on to that, the costumes, because there must be lots of costumes dating back to the silk routes that you've spoken about before.
Yes,
do you use
absolutely.
A particular kind of costume?
Belly dancing is great fun for that. You can use as much bling as you want, but you can also make it quite tribal looking.
And rings and castanets and things like that?
We don't use castanets in belly dance, but we do use finger symbols. Mm. Yes, lots of jewellery, lots of bright and shiny fun things.
And does it enhance, do you think it enhances people's beauty? It's a way of showing off their beauty, isn't it?
Well, it certainly improves your posture, which automatically enhances your beauty, I think, because you show yourself more. So, yes, and also just the experience of expressing yourself in a sexy way will make you feel more sexy.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Okay, so if people want to get in touch with you and they want to learn how to do it, how do they do it?
So they can look at my website, which is www.laylladance.com.
Yeah.
And Layla is spelt L-E-Y-L-A.
Right.
So it's laylladance.com.
And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you enjoyed the hour here on Cambridge 105 Radio.